Hello and welcome to the Recovering from Religion podcast. Our mission here is to offer hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. What follows is the audio from selected videos posted on Recovering from Religion's YouTube channel. So sit back, relax, and enjoy. Ladies and gentlemen, it is my distinct pleasure to introduce you to Tora Bontrager, and she escaped in the middle of a night at the age of 15 so she could go to high school and from her formerly Amish community. She is the author of Amish Girl in Manhattan, and to her knowledge, she's the first female Amish escapee to graduate from the Ivy League. Her story has been featured on MTV and Forbes.com, among other places. Today, she advocates for the right of Amish children to go to school beyond the eighth grade. And Tora has also founded the Amish Heritage Foundation, which we're going to be talking about in an upcoming episode. The Amish Heritage Foundation focuses on making education a federal right and overturning the Supreme Court case, Wisconsin versus Yoder. So Tora, welcome. Welcome, welcome.
Thank you.
Now, we had some poll questions. What I'd like to do is, normally we start this at the very beginning and people can answer it as we go. But what I'd like to do is kind of read them off and people can kind of think about them while we're kind of talking. Is that all right with you?
Yes.
Great. All right, so the first question, poll question that we had is, who founded the Amish? What was the name of the person that founded the Amish? Jacob Hutter, Jacob Amon, Menno Simmons, or William Penn? So those are who founded the Amish. Question number two, what is Rumspringa? Rumspringa refers to a period of time from the age of 16 or 17 until you get married inside the Amish religion. Or is it when Amish children turn 16, the rules change, they're encouraged to experiment and explore outside the world, then choose whether or not to become baptized members of the Amish religion? Or is it about having a fling with worldliness, which reminds Amish youth that they have a choice regarding church membership? Or finally, is Rumspringa a rite of passage, which the usual behavioral restrictions are relaxed so that Amish youth can acquire some experience and knowledge of the non-Amish world? Question number three, if you're a U.S. citizen, do you have a right to education? It's much better if you can see these visually, but the first answer is, are you kidding me? Everybody does. This is America. Question number two, is this a trick question? Or answer number two, I thought so until you asked. Now I'm not sure. Answer number three, of course, even undocumented immigrants have the right to go to public school. Or answer number four, nope, it is not a right. And then finally, question number four is, have you heard of Wisconsin v. Yoder? We talked about it in Tora's intro. And you can say, I've never heard of it. I have no idea of what Wisconsin versus Yoder is. I've heard of it from a family or a church member, or I've heard of it in a law school if you went to law school, or I heard of it in a class or at some other school that's not a law school. So I didn't launch the poll at all. I was just kind of reading them so you guys can kind of get thinking about it. So with that in mind, Tora, in your bio, you hinted at like a really fascinating story about leaving in the middle of the night. We had on here earlier this month, Nathan Phelps, who left the Westboro Baptist Church in the middle of the night when he turned 18. And it sounds like you did something similar, but much earlier in life than he did. So do you mind telling us a little bit about your story?
Yes. So I had to, even though as an American citizen, I was born in the United States of America, I had to literally flee in the middle of the night just to have a chance at going to high school and college. And that's wow. Not usually what people think of when they think of America, even yeah. Whether you're, you know, a mainstream American or a member, you know, a citizen of another country. But I had to do that in order to go to school. past the eighth grade, and also just to flee other kinds of abuses that I was subjected to. And we can go into those if you want to, in terms of constitutional rights. Like, I won't even cover human rights. We're just going to talk about constitutional rights.
So born into an Amish community, I would imagine you don't just walk into it and become a part of it. You were born into this. And what part of the U.S. was this in?
This was in the Midwest in Iowa. I was born in Iowa, so the heartland of America. My family moved to Wisconsin when I was 3 years old, and then to Michigan when I was 10 years old, between 10 and 11 years old that year. And so this was middle America. This wasn't Pennsylvania, which is usually what is associated with the Amish in pop culture. It was definitely, you know, Midwestern, what you think of as the real America.
Yeah. The breadbasket almost in some sense. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Like Wisconsin before California, Wisconsin was, you know, the dairy, you know, state, or technically still is, but, yeah, definitely where we get our cheese and milk and all of that from.
So you were living in an Amish community, and it sound, and from what I can imagine, like, that's all you knew. Did you have any exposure to the outside world at all while you were in it?
Yes. One of the things to understand about the Amish is that we're not physically separated from the rest of the world. So it's not like the Hutterites, which falls under the Anabaptist umbrella. We can talk about that a little bit more later. But we actually live in rural America with no physical barriers. We have non-Amish neighbors. Anybody who's not Amish is, you know, called English from our point of view, our perspective. You're English if you're not Amish. Oh, yeah.
You're not even American.
Yeah. That's a very, very interesting thing to be aware of, is that we do not think of the rest of the world as anything but English. So, you know, whether you are from China and speak Chinese, or from, you know, anybody in the rest of the U.S. and not Amish, you're English.
Now, where does that come from? Why is that term is used?
Well, it's a way to, for us from the inside as Amish practitioners, to distinguish ourselves from the rest of the world. So our attempt as someone who is born inside the Amish religion and is obligated to remain practicing the religion the rest of our lives, that's a way to mark that non-physical barrier. And that's also why, as someone who is born Amish, speaking the language is such an effective non-physical barrier. So if the language weren't there, the boundary would be a little bit more blurry.
We've had quite a few of these religion spotlights, and one of the common threads is how the adherents see the rest of the world as other, and they seem to paint it as a scary, scary place, and you can only be safe, you can only be happy within this religious community. And what you've described right there seems to hint at that. Growing up, did you feel that the outside world was a scary place? Were you kind of taught that it was other?
Yes. Everything not Amish is the devil's playground. That's the phrase that's used, is the devil's playground. And but it gets a little murky though when you get older. Especially once you're baptized, you understand that the devil's playground doesn't extend to anyone who's an offshoot of Amish or Mennonite, who's conservative enough that they wear that the women wear caps on their head, and that there are no women in leadership, such as clergy. And you can actually transfer your church membership. You can join another church that's an offshoot of Amish or super conservative Mennonite without getting into trouble with the Amish church. But that's not something that you, depending on the community you come from or the family you come from, that you know about when you're not baptized. It's only something that's disclosed to you after baptism, again, depending on what. So it gets a little murky. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense. So there's this sort of, you know, belief and training that if you're born, you know, in the Amish church, it's your duty, obligation to remain Amish, practicing Amish for the rest of your life, unless you join certain select offshoots or Mennonites.
And so for you, kind of growing up and before you ran away at midnight, what were some of the first couple of cracks in your the worldview you kind of were born with or you were given? Like what caused you to kind of second guess what you were being taught?
One of the questions I had that couldn't be answered to my satisfaction was, why can't we have a car? Why can't we drive a car, but we can pay someone else to drive for us?
So it was almost like, it's okay to do these things as long as it's one of the people that's already in the out group that's in the devil's playground. They can take the responsibility for it. But if you're noticing you're still benefiting from it, did it feel a little bit hypocritical? Is that?
Yes. I love that you brought up that word hypocritical. That was a word that I latched onto, was that this is very hypocritical. And an interesting sort of side note is that I wasn't taught that word. I read the dictionary at like in the seventh and eighth grades from cover to cover just to expand my vocabulary and found that word.
Wow. Oh, interesting. Now, was this something that was frowned upon? Like when you were reading to educate yourself, I know some of the other people that we've spoken to coming out of these kind of religions, you know, have talked about, you know, their sort of religious community trying to stop them from gaining any additional knowledge that wasn't being provided to them and sanctioned by the church leaders. Was that the case for you as well?
Yes, there was definitely there was a censorship depending on what community you grew up in. I was fortunate enough to be born into a community that, although it was on the strictest end of the traditional Amish, allowed me to read what would be considered classic American and British children's literature, for example. You know, the Boxcar Children, Anne of Green Gables, a very like 50-ish sort of books that you would read in public school. And the schools in the towards the more modern end of the spectrum that are the smaller communities, not necessarily the larger communities, they tend to be more censored. It's almost as if the more they allow you to have material conveniences like indoor bathrooms and cell phones and bicycles, the more they have to compensate by censoring certain kinds of books. And wow. So from first through fourth grade, I had a super, super conservative experience, but with access to the public library and access to basically the public sort of curriculum of books to read in terms of English literature. And then from the fifth to eighth grade, that switch when we moved to Michigan, where it was a super small community, more liberal in terms of modern conveniences, but very censored in terms of the Amish school curriculum.
Ooh, that must have been a shock. Now, speaking of books, is there a particular holy book that is normally read by the Amish, or a series of books?
That is a very interesting question, again, which I love, which you would never get unless it comes from an Amish insider, the real answer.
Ooh, wow. We're going to get the dish, ladies and gentlemen. This is
breaking
juicy.
Down barriers.
Oh, knock it off with the bear.
I love it, Kara.
I'm here all night, y'all.
So in terms of a holy book, we're Christian, Protestant version of Christianity, but a very extreme fanatical interpretation of it coming out of the Protestant Reformation of 1525. And anyone who knows their history a little bit will know that that happened in 1525 with Martin Luther, who nailed these theses on the Catholic Church door, proclaiming blah, 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 essentially that you should have give the church sermons in the lay person's language instead of Latin. And fast forward to how the Amish came about. We're under the Anabaptist umbrella, and Anabaptist is essentially means that we don't believe that infant baptism is valid. And the only baptism that is valid is if you were baptized as a consenting, knowledgeable adult.
You know, this baptism thing really seems to be a big sticking point between like all sorts of the siblings of Christianity. The more I learn about the different bits of Christianity and why they split up, more often than not, it's because of the baptism thing. Like what, you can't get baptized as a child, or if you get baptized once, you're always going to go to heaven or something like that. This is such a big sticking point and confusing point for people in the Christian religion. That's so interesting.
So speaking of which, or if you already mentioned this, I'm sorry, but had you already been baptized then by the time you started rethinking this? Or like, what age does that typically happen for people that they're considered old enough to decide to be baptized and make that commitment?
Another excellent question. You don't really have a choice not to get baptized. And that's one of the myths in popular culture, that rumspringa means that you have an actual choice. But rumspringa is only today, you know, 300-400 years later, is a definition of time. It's a period of time from age 16 or 17, depending on the community you're in, living in, until you get married inside the religion. And you are expected to get baptized. What happens during that time is going to depend, again, on the community you're living in. Like, how much are the baptized members, the clergy, going to look away and sort of like just, you know, give you some leeway if you break the rules, with the understanding that you're eventually going to sow your wild oats and return to the fold, right? Or become a baptized member. Other communities that are, and that will happen more in the larger, older communities, where I liken it to, if you live in New York City, there's hundreds and hundreds of teens, and you have a lot harder time controlling them than if you live in a little small community in rural America with, you know, 100 people as your population. It's a lot easier to control the teens. And so the community that I grew up in really strictly monitored the teens. I would never have been able to drink and party and so forth once I turned 16. So I knew, and there's also a lot of pressure to get baptized, even younger. So in the older, bigger communities, generally speaking, lots of kids don't get baptized until right before marriage, because you cannot get married until you're baptized.
Whoa, really?
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Huh. So,
and yeah, go ahead.
So Rumstringer is like the time between the age of 16 and you get married, pretty much. Mm-hmm. And what's the average age do you feel like the Amish get married?
It depends again on the community that you live in. The smaller communities that are more on the liberal end in terms of modern conveniences, like phones, bicycles, and so forth, they tend to try to get their youth to get baptized younger. Okay. And they specifically left the big communities to start up small communities and restrict the small communities to around 30 families in order to keep control over the teenagers, the unbaptized members. And the bigger communities, bigger and older, tend to, again, it depends on whether it's an older, bigger community that's conservative or more liberal. The more conservative communities, they usually, again, marry young, 20, 21, something like that. The older ones who are bigger and more liberal might even now, depending on the community, be in their mid-20s for the women, for the girls, and perhaps even in the early 30s for the men. So there's a disparity Wow. between the age of the girls versus the boys.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
Because even in the older communities that are more lenient and more modern, or especially more lenient, because lenient and modern doesn't necessarily go together. the boys will always have more latitude than the girls.
Mm-hmm. Now, go ahead, Kara. Sorry.
Oh, I was just going to say, someone brought up in the chat an interesting question. Are these arranged marriages, or how are people selecting their marriage partners, or are they selecting their marriage partners?
It's not arranged. So technically, you know, there's no arranged marriage happening. That's not traditional Amish custom. But depending on who your parents are, if you're a girl, you would not be able to get the permission to get married without your parents' permission. Whereas if you're a boy, then again, there's that, you know, disparity, there's that difference there, that the boy would be allowed, you know, would not have the same barriers that the girl would, because women are literally second class citizens inferior to men.
This, again, we talked about the religions creating a sense of like tribalism, like, and everything else is bad, but this misogyny too is a really common theme in all of these other religions as well. And I'll be honest, Tor, I'm so grateful to have a woman to come on and talk about it from the woman's perspective, because I know if I went through it as a man, I wouldn't fully be able to understand how the women experience this. So this is great. I'm really glad you're willing to talk about this.
You know what it's like to journey out of a once cherished belief. Maybe you were devoutly religious, escaped a cult, or perhaps you simply navigated out of some very difficult days, and now you'd like to help someone else do the same. Recovering from Religion is a wonderful support organization for people who feel confused, troubled, and alone as they come to grips with the possibility that they no longer hold a religious belief, or that they risk losing everything if they're honest with themselves and others about their journeys. These people need our help, and Recovering from Religion needs yours. RFR is seeking volunteers. Perhaps you're formerly religious, or you have a specific skill set like speaking a foreign language, Maybe you're just a good listening ear. The RFR Volunteer Training Program will help you translate those abilities into critical assistance, encouragement, and support for the men, women, and youth who contact RFR every day from all over the world. You can relate. You can understand. And you can make their journeys easier. Join the team at Recovering From Religion and remind someone else that they are not alone and someone is here to help. To find out more, click the volunteer tab at recoveringfromreligion.org.
Thank you. I'm glad someone's happy to hear this because you touch on something that's an issue, which is part of my work is to correct the Amish narrative in pop culture, which has been constructed by males who are not Amish for the most part, you know, but who are adjacent, like Mennonite or offshoots of Amish, and you just don't hear the women's voice or an educated woman's voice just because of the disparity that happens.
Yeah, it almost sounds like they want to prevent that from happening. If you're prevented from being educated, then you can't comment.
Let's get to we'll get to the pop culture stuff a little bit later, but I think we didn't hear what the holy book was.
Good. I'm glad you came back to that.
Yeah.
Yes, I was going to bring that up. And you're amazing at keeping this on track, Eric. I appreciate it. So the Holy Book is in its Christian Protestantism is the umbrella that it falls under. But the Old and New Testament, the Bible, is the King James Version in English. That's the only version that is considered acceptable in English. And in German, it's Martin Luther.
So there's an entirely different Bible, like a Martin Luther version, like of the Bible?
Well, it's supposedly the same version. but the translation in German is Martin Luther's translation from 1520, Martin Luther from 1525 from the Reformation. And then the English translation is King James.
Now, this may be getting a little too deep into the weeds here, but I mean, do you or anyone you know, have you compared those versions? Are they in fact what you would consider to be identical? I mean, it's kind of a loaded question, but...
Yeah, I was not able at age 11 to really discern the difference. And the issue was, I mean, at age 11 was when I read the Bible from cover to cover in English, and I don't understand German. We are taught, depending again on what school you go to, what Amish school you go to, you're taught German, but it's only to read the Bible and regurgitate. It's not to speak. So our language that we speak is not German, is not standard German, it's Amish. It's its own language and meets the socio-political criteria to be its own language, even though etymologists or those who are not Amish, who are claimed to be experts in the Amish, will not recognize that we speak our own language. They'll say, oh, it's a dialect of German. But that's again a whole other issue that I am working on as part of my life's work to establish. We have our own language. I mean, authentic linguists agree. And so anyway, all of that to say that for us to attend as children Amish church, if the most of the service, depending on who the minister or bishop is delivering the sermon, is, you know, just regurgitating German Bible verses. And we can't understand that as children.
That's no different than having the service in Latin, isn't it?
Exactly. So that is one of my arguments, is that 300-400 years later, the Amish church is no different from the Catholic church that the Amish rebelled against back in the Reformation.
That seems silly to me, but I think that's a bad judgment on my part, but
and then before I forget it, no, I agree with you, Eric. Before I forget it, I just want to add that the Amish church does have, as its traditional stance, includes the Apocrypha, at least in German.
You're kidding me.
Oh.
Not necessarily in English, because when you buy the King James Version of the Bible, it doesn't necessarily include the Apocrypha. But in German, if you buy the Martin Luther version of the Bible in German, that German version, it includes the Apocrypha, which is exactly in the middle of the Old and New Testaments. So there's the Apocrypha.
Yeah, so real quick, what is the Apocrypha? You said it's like additional books that you don't find in your normal run-of-the-mill King James Version. Like, what books are would you find in the Apocrypha?
It would be in English, Tobit, T-O-B-I-T, in German, Tobias, is the book of Tobit or Tobias. I believe another one is the book of Esther. I would have to look and see, but the reason I remember Tobit specifically is because that is actually the story of Tobit is recited during Amish marriage ceremonies.
Yeah.
And that's the most obvious reference to the Apocrypha. And again, that's not going to be, might not even be mentioned in the more liberal but censored smaller Amish communities where they think, oh, well, the Apocrypha is actually, it's too superstitious and we shouldn't include that anymore.
Now, I remember as a kid how boring it was to be in church on Sunday, and every now and then I'd get smacked because I'd start to fall asleep. I could have, but I understood English, and that's how the sermons and were given. If you're telling me that the sermons in the Amish church were given in German, and as a kid, I would there'd be no hope for me to not fall asleep, to stay awake. What was it like for you as a kid going every Sunday to the, or is the holy day on a Sunday? I'm just kind of making an assumption here.
Yes. So the holy day is on Sunday. God created the world in 6 days and rested on the seventh day, which is Sunday. But we only go to church every other Sunday. So our excruciating 3-hour church service on hard benches with no backs, somehow, you know, like we only have to endure it every 2 weeks and not every Sunday.
Our pews had cushions on them. And you're telling me that these are wood benches just like they would have had back in the 16th century?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yes. And it goes back to this underlying obvious and not so obvious theology or cult of martyrdom that underpins Anabaptism and the Amish in particular, like any forms of conservative, super conservative of Anabaptism.
Okay, so you're demonstrating your commitment by being uncomfortable for 3 hours, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
Did you guys again,
you will never hear any practicing Amish person express this, and I would not have been able to express this, put this in words before I escaped or even after I escaped, shortly after I escaped. It took me a long time, you know, to understand the psychology of what was happening.
Oh, so this is not something that is explicit then. They're not saying, yes, we know you're uncomfortable, children. The meaning behind this exercise is that we want you to, you know, reflect on the sacrifices of Jesus or anything like that.
Mm-mm. No, no. This is all something that, again, yeah, points back to this idea that we need to be non-resistant, and that's an operative key word for Anabaptists and especially Amish, which the Amish fall on the conservative spectrum of various Anabaptist groups, that we the more we suffer, the more likely we are to get into heaven. It's not said that way out loud, but that's the way it plays out. And that's the, again, the psychology behind it. We don't understand psychology. We're only eighth graders at best. That's what's going on. And
even the adults have the eighth grade that's where they stop. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they're running communities.
I know. Yeah. And even for myself, it took me years until I could frame it in those words, to put words around what the experience is, what the society is like, what the culture is like. We are eighth graders. We're a nation of eighth graders at best. The average practicing Amish adult has a fifth grade literacy level, English literacy level, not even German. Grade? Yeah. And a third or fourth numeracy level.
Yikes.
And so you put that on top of, 350 to 400,000 people in America across 30 states or so, approximately 30 states. That's who we are today in the 21st century. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just wondering, is this something that is talked about? I mean, do they give a reasoning behind, why they don't want education to progress past that point? What's the stated explanation here?
In the beginning, when the Amish first immigrated from Europe, there weren't restrictions around education. The Amish children attended public schools just like everybody else, like all other immigrants, until especially in the 60s, it became evident in Wisconsin or in Iowa, for example, there were little uprisings against public school curriculums before that. But the most obvious case that you can see on the record is the so-called Amish Revolution in Iowa in 1965. And this was in Buchanan County, which is actually the community I was born into, was Buchanan County, Iowa, one of the oldest Amish communities and one of the strictest. And there had been pushback against the public school district off and on since maybe the 40s or 50s about what the kids were being taught in public school. But the public school, consistently made these accommodations in the interest of religious freedom exemptions for the parents, in terms of the kids weren't being taught Darwin's theory, for example, or any other kinds of ideas or subjects that were contrary, to the Amish religion, to the parents' religious beliefs. And the kids would just sit out those classes or not be taught them by the public school teachers. And then in the 60s, in the state of Iowa, because of funding and so forth on the state level or federal level, the state started consolidating the school districts and started moving, bussing children in from rural areas, from rural one-room schoolhouses, because everybody used to go to one-room schoolhouses in rural areas, into consolidated schools in the biggest town in the area, however the districting worked, right? And that's the point at which the Amish, particularly the Buchanan County Amish in this case, said, okay, we're not okay with our kids being in going into town, being taken out of the one room schools and going into the public schools in town. And at that point, it was rare for non-Amish children to be in the one-room schoolhouses in Buchanan County, because Buchanan County was so big, and it just worked out that it was basically by default, almost all, if not all, only Amish kids in the one-room schoolhouses, but they were still taught by non-Amish teachers. Certified teachers by the state were taught, because that's, you know, how our government system works. they then said they're not fine with the kids. The Buchanan County Amish were split between, the community was split between some parents saying, we don't want our kids to go into the public schools to be taught, you know, to be intermingling with the non-Amish kids, and others saying, well, we don't mind if they're taught, continue to be taught by the non-Amish school teachers, as long as they're still in the one-room schoolhouses. And others saying, well, we need to install our own teachers, our Amish teachers, who aren't certified, who aren't educated past the Amish eighth grade. And so that was happening during the 60s. In 1965, you know, the school board, the state of Iowa school board, decided that it's rightfully decided that children need to go to school past the age of 14. And it was more the issue in Iowa was that they need to be educated at least by certified teachers until the age of 14. So the Amish had in that state, they had, the state did have an exemption for kids who worked on farms after age 14, I believe it was. So it didn't matter if you were non-Amish or Amish, you could apply for that exemption. So the issue in Wisconsin was not like the same issue that was in Wisconsin, where we'll get to later. In Iowa, it was about whether the kids were being taught until at least age 14, until they got an exemption to work on farms, you know, that they were taught by certified, state certified teachers. And so in 1965, there was at least one schoolhouse in Buchanan County, Iowa. There was more than one, but one schoolhouse got the attention that went, you know, where the state sent out school buses to this Amish one-room schoolhouse that was employing an Amish teacher that wasn't certified. And the school district had notified the parents the day before or whenever it was that, hey, we're going to send out the school bus to pick up the kids, take them into the school, the town school, the consolidated school, because you don't have a certified teacher installed. And the day that the school bus came out, along with some administrators, there was an AP Associated Press photographer or someone affiliated with the Associated Press on board. You know, I mean, this was like a big event, who rode with the school board officials, and they came to this Amish schoolhouse and they were going to load up the kids. And some of the parents were there waiting for the bus to arrive on the Amish school grounds. And when it did arrive, they said, spring, spring, spring to the Veschkenfeld, run, run to the cornfields, to tell the kids to run to the cornfield, literally run. And so they couldn't be loaded up on the school bus, couldn't be forced onto the school bus. And that's where you have this photo that went viral. That was like the equivalent of social media during that day, that time. Yeah.
Now, so they literally must have been, oh, go ahead.
You turn the kids into children of the corn. Like, just get the heck out of here. And wow. That.
Yeah.
Wow.
Right. And it also played into the martyrdom and innocence narrative. Right. Right. You know, the theology of martyrdom that we Amish kids grew up with inside the church, and to outsiders, this narrative of innocence. Oh my God, the poor children, the poor, innocent, harmless Amish, how dare you like put them on the school bus? But we have to remember that the children were never considered in this narrative. It was all about the parents, and the narrative that was spun was that this was a violation of religious freedom, but it was never acknowledged that the children also are U.S. citizens with their own right to freedoms.
And it must have been scary for the children as well. Were they told, I mean, what story were the children given that they needed to, you know, flee into the cornfields for?
Well, that was something that they were prepped with beforehand, you know, already, mm-hmm. you know, so this was something that was, it wasn't like the state of Iowa and the local school board weren't accommodating all along and hadn't been making religious freedom exemptions for the parents for years already. You know, that's mm-hmm. that's not the case, which is always not acknowledged. It's always spun as if, oh, there were never religious freedom exemptions made beforehand. No, this had been happening for at least, you know, 20, 15, 10 years, something like that. And, but, you know, the children were all prepped. If you see the school bus, I mean, that's why there were parents, specifically fathers, on the school grounds that morning, waiting for the bus to come and ordering the children to run into the cornfields to avoid being put on the bus. And in that photo, supposedly that photo, one of the children is one of my uncles. I mean, we can never verify that because we only see the backs of the children running into the cornfield. But I'm just saying this to say I'm like very intimately connected to what led up to Wisconsin v. Yoder, the Supreme Court case in 1972, which then built on this event. And in Wisconsin, you know, got the Supreme Court at that point, like took it all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court to make this exemption for Amish, for the Amish religion, to not allow their children to go to school past the eighth grade.
Wow.
So that Supreme Court case now, that still stands, and that's the reason that they are not educated past the eighth grade?
Yes. Yep.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
That case, in fact, because of what happened in 1965, like that was really now sort of like that was really the, you know, the breaking point. And because it went national and international, that incident, the Iowa public school, the state of Iowa, backed down because there was all this outrage from people, you know, letters coming in. So before social media, people wrote letters and there are all these letters coming in to the superintendent of the local school district and, you know, to the state education board of Iowa about how dare you persecute these poor, innocent Amish people, right? Basically was the sentiment. Wow. And so Iowa backed down. And before that, Iowa was rightfully advocating for the children. They backed down from that outrage from the general public. And unfortunately, they didn't have anybody like me, you know, on the inside or like, you know, the Amish Heritage Foundation saying, no, you need to stand your ground. You need to think about the children, right? So this then gave way to the Yoder case, Wisconsin versus Yoder in 1972. Some of the families from Buchanan County, Iowa, moved away from Iowa to this Wisconsin community where the Yoder case rose out from. And there were other, you know, families from other bigger communities moving to Iowa, partially because they thought they would get more leniency in Wisconsin as opposed to Pennsylvania or Ohio, for example, when it came to the kids being in school. And all of this, the argument in Wisconsin was then compulsory. The state's compulsory education age was 16 in 1972 in the 1970s. And the Amish, led by Jonas Yoder, who wasn't even a clergy member, he was just, you know, a regular layperson, but a, you know, one of the, what I call the bullies of the Amish community, decided that his, you know, he does not want his children to go to school until age 16 after the eighth grade. Like, what's, you know, two more years of school is not going to give them anything. And the school district in Wisconsin, like all the school districts in all other states, pretty much had accommodated, you know, all these religious freedom exemptions already, including that Wisconsin school that Jonas Yoder was in. But he decided, you know, no, I'm going to object to my kids going to school until age 16. I don't care what accommodations you made, you know, for all other things. The kids were already not being taught, you know, biology and so forth, right? And so he built his own schoolhouse and took all the children out of the Amish children out of the non-Amish school district. And here's what happened. It was in the best interest of the school, the public school district, to have Amish children in attendance, because they would get more funding. The higher your numbers of students, the more funding you get from the state. And so one of the things that the discussions that happened was that one of the school district officials at some point, the superintendent, said, well, just send your kids to, you know, public school until such and such time, where we can get credit for, you know, to get funding for the number of kids that are in our school. And after that, you can remove them and we won't, you know, force you or prosecute, you know, you if the kids aren't coming to school anymore. So
oh. Yeah. And we'll go more in detail mm-hmm. about the Wisconsin versus Yoder with the upcoming talk on the Amish Heritage Foundation itself, right?
Perfect. Yeah.
So let's if you don't mind, put a bookmark in this, and we'll bring it back up in a couple of episodes. But let's get back more to the Amish itself, because kind of what you're bringing up, this whole martyr thing is freaking fascinating to me, because from the outside, I want to handle the Amish with kid gloves, you know, but it seems like that's exactly what they want us to do. Like, just like, oh, they're quaint. Oh, they're soft and fluffy, and they're not hurting anybody. It's not harmful at all. And just some of the things that you're bringing up already, I can already see my mindset shifting about them too. During the church meetings every other week, did you guys sing at all, or dance? Like, was that no-nos too? Because it's sounding like that's where this is heading. Like, no happiness at all for the most part.
We sang hymns that were written by the martyrs in our church services every 2 weeks. The hymns we sang were written by martyrs, Anabaptist martyrs. And I want to add to our holy book, the non-biblical book that was considered next to the Bible was the Martyr's Mirror. And the Martyr's Mirror was a thick book of like 1500 pages originally, that contains stories of Anabaptists or predecessors of Anabaptists who literally died at the stake, like were burned alive. Whoa. Literally for not complying with the Catholic Church.
Wow. This runs deep.
Yeah, these are historical figures then from Europe.
Mm-hmm. Yes, from Europe. Yes.
Oh.
Like actual historical accounts. And just to give you a very brief background, in the 500s or something, I believe it was. Let me just see my notes. I believe it was in the 500s or so, and maybe even earlier. You were not allowed to go against the Catholic Church doctrines. Mm-hmm. And one of those things that you weren't allowed to do had something to do with being baptized by heretics that the Catholic Church considered heretics. So if you were baptized by them or baptized again by them, you were a heretic, and like literally by Roman law, like the Roman, you know, and Catholic Church were like functioning as the same pretty much. That was punishable by death. And so that was still happening in the 1500s when the Protestant Reformation started. Like that law was still in place that you could not be baptized as an adult, which the Anabaptists held that. So the technical thing for the Anabaptists was that your infant baptism was never valid. And so technically we're not rebaptizers, which Anabaptist, the Greek word translation is rebaptizer. And the Anabaptists was to say, no, we're not rebaptizing. We never had a baptism in the beginning. And, but in the eyes of the Roman Church and you know, Roman Catholic Church and Roman law, they were still subject to heresy and death.
You know, this baptism thing seems to be such a schism. And all-knowing, almighty God might have thought about that ahead of time and made it clear in one of the books, Old Testament, New Testament, like, okay, here is about the baptism, and this is clearly laid out, and then we wouldn't have had these schisms, and there'd be harmony and stuff. Just
well, Eric, don't you know it's very clear? It's just that everyone else is confused about it.
So the Anabaptist starts, and the Mennonites came before Anabaptists, and they were started by that Menno Simons.
Yeah.
Menno Simons.
So no, the Anabaptists were not before them. Well, the concept of Anabaptism was before the Anabaptists, right? Anabaptists as a concept or term was by the Romans, Roman law, the Catholic Church, right? And so they would say that Anabaptists, what became known as Anabaptists later on, were in violation of the law. Like it was considered, the term Anabaptist was considered the same as like what we would consider communist or Bolshevik or socialist. Yeah, okay. You know, that kind of like stigmatism and
so Anabaptist is like a concept, and then Mennonites is more
in Roman law and Roman Catholic Church law, it was an actual law, like you could not